Wi-Fi party line.
Welcome to another episode of the Sci-Fi Party Line podcast. This is your hostess, Kat, and today I have with me Carl.
What's happening, Kat?
Hey. And back again is Eric.
Hey, I never knew I left.
I mean, you know, back again for this episode, not that you're left and... yeah, so folks, that's Eric, and today we're going to talk about The Walking Dead and The Hobbit. So those filthy hobbitses. Opening the show, we're going to go first. Walking Dead, the season is now over, correct?
Well, the half season for sure.
Half season, okay. And we get to just say how we really felt about this first part of the season. And I have to say that I was... really impressed. It is a major improvement from last season, which we were on the farm the whole time. It's one of those shows that I was looking forward to week after week. I actually had to pay for this with my own money because, you know, I buy it off of iTunes, so it was worth that to me. And I think we were really treated with some good stuff this season. Carl?
Totally agree. It was exciting that they brought in some new characters this season. You're always worried that they're going to start to run down or you're going to hear the same stories again and again. We got some new folks, new blood, so to speak, into the cast, and they're using them in interesting ways. Hopefully, they're not going to be one-to-one replacements for folks we've lost, but let's see how that goes, you know. But, still beautiful, still exciting. I'm enjoying it.
Eric?
That's one of the best things I've seen on TV in a long time. And, you know, everyone knows how most people feel about season two. And I felt that way as well initially when I saw it. But as I've told you before offline, I went back and rewatched all of season two not too long before season three started up again. And I really enjoyed it a lot more the second time through. I actually liked it quite a lot more. It wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it was. Of course, a lot of that had to do with me catching up and reading all the comics during the interim. That makes a big difference as well. But even though season two was improved, for me, season three was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
My goodness. Phenomenal.
What was, Eric, because I don't think I've talked to you about The Walking Dead the whole season, semester, whatever. What was the standout things to you?
Well, it's interesting. Well, it's...
Just hold on to... Carl?
Yes.
What are you eating?
What are you talking about?
I hear some crunching.
There is no crunching.
I hear something crunching. If you have a zombie in your room and you're crunching.
It is absolutely inaudible to the folks at home.
No, so you are. That's... Okay, now that he's gotten that out of his system, Eric, please continue. My apologies.
Goodness. This is Gorilla Podcast. well, I'm not sure. It's strange because one of the things that really kind of took me by surprise, not necessarily in a bad way, but more or less, give or take, the pacing of season one and two versus the comic, it was about one episode per one issue. Okay. So there was 13 in season two or whatever, 12 or 13? Whatever. We had like 16 or 18 episodes combining season one and two. And that's about how far they went in the comics, was about 18 issues or whatever, more or less, with the farm and everything else. And so I always just assumed that's how it would continue to be. But with this first half of season three, they really picked up the pace. And so how many episodes? We got like seven episodes or something?
Something like that.
We've had eight so far.
We got eight. So in eight episodes, instead of covering maybe eight issues of the comic, they kind of did like 20 issues of the comic in 8 episodes, and I was just like, oh my gosh, like, hold on to your hats, because, like, it's like overdrive now. And I was really, like, I wasn't expecting to cover so much ground so quickly. Again, not necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, if they would have stayed with the same pace, you know, perhaps people would have been pissed if everything would have been, you know, dragged out again the way it was on the farm.
Well, they would have lost viewers.
Yeah, so, you know, probably not a bad thing. But that was just something I just had to get used to on my own. That being said, what's so much fun is just because you read the comic, it doesn't mean that the whole plot's going to be spoiled on you. It actually makes it super fun because anybody go out there and read it, at least read the first 50 issues or so. Well, if you read the first 50, you won't be able to stop, but you'll come into the TV series brimming with confidence because you're going to feel like, ha, 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 I know exactly what's going to happen now. I've seen this all. And then that's when they really get you, is when you're confident and because you think you know because you've already read it. And to me, that's when the surprises, like, exponentially increase and just get so much more fun. And it was really fun to see the twists that I wasn't expecting, because I thought it was going to go a different way. And it was just fun as hell, to be honest. It's really fun.
So we had an introduction of a new character that a lot of people have been waiting on for a while. The first for last part of the season was Michonne. And then now Tyrese has been introduced. How excited are you about that? Don't tell me, don't spoil me on anything, but were you excited about his coming?
That's what she said. That was the biggest wow moment I had in the mid-season finale. That was like the biggest virtual high five to everybody in the room for me. Was Tyrese. I was just like, I did not see that coming, and I was overjoyed, and I'm sure many, many other fanboys and girls were overjoyed as well. That was a huge thing. That was a huge thing.
So let's go elephant in the room. And so we have the death of T-Dog, and then we had the death of random black prisoner. So, like, I'm concerned about the lifespan of Tyrese at this point.
Come on. You know, everybody's so excited to have him on there. He's going to make it now. He's going to make it.
I don't know. So, you know, because at first we thought that T-Dog was supposed to be Tyrese, and then he wasn't adding up to what he needed to do in order to be that character. So,
that is correct.
Yeah, and he made it like two whole seasons, two and a half seasons.
Without much dialogue.
Right.
So
that's what's really hard to get. I'm sitting here trying to figure out, you know, okay, well, if they're not using him as the Tyrese character, then what's going on? You know, why is he here holding the place? Or, you know, is he going to do something new? Is he going to bring something different to the experience? And
it was always my kind of little theory, I mean, before we even saw season 3, about T-Dog was, like, with, you know, when we thought he was like the pseudo Tyrese, but with all his de-emphasis and character that you just talked about, I always kind of thought it was because Daryl was there.
Yes, I think you have mentioned
that. It seemed like Daryl, because Daryl doesn't exist in the comics, spoiler. Mm-hmm. And Daryl's character being there in the show and being who he is, it kind of like filled the void that was left by the missing Tyrese or T-Dog. And so he's sort of like, and I'm not saying that Tyrese is the same character as Daryl, not at all, but I'm just saying he just filled that, like, you know, leadership role, that void that was missing. Mm-hmm. So he kind of like took his place in a weird way.
So if Daryl is the pseudo Tyrese, then what's Tyrese?
Well, that's going to be damn interesting to find out.
Okay. Yeah, it was kind of a rhetorical question. I didn't really want you to answer that anyway.
I mean, I have my ideas and thoughts.
Yeah, what? We don't want Eric ideas. Simmer down, young man, because you'll be spoiling it in a minute. I don't know. Yeah. I think one of my favorite parts of the series was just figuring out where the governor was coming from. Without spoilers, if you can, does he add up or match up to the comic book governor, or is he kind of new?
Are you asking me again?
Yes.
at first, like early in season three, he was a bit of a disappointment to me. He didn't live up to what the impression I got from the comics. Because he's very
like
similar
better
but
worse
different.
Or what?
He seemed like a much weaker character, maybe. Mm-hmm. I guess one way to put it is that in the comic, he just seems a lot more insane a lot earlier on. And he just, you know, he's larger than life in an insane way. And the way the governor was presented in the TV show, he just seemed much more sedated and under control and calm. And so you weren't really sure, are they playing a different angle? Are they trying to trick us? Or is he just... Because let's just be honest, a lot of things that happen in Woodbury in the comic is just way too graphic for TV. So it was always a weird question, like, how is this going to play out? Like,
oh,
now
I'm
really
curious. Well, Carl, did you kind of feel that the governor was watered down, and did you want something more from him?
Well, I was very concerned because we'd seen that part of the story before. Remember where you go into the town? We'd seen it before, and it was freakish because the very same week it happened on Revolution.
And Falling Skies.
You know, so I was like, come on, give me something new. This is, you know, I expect something bigger from Walking Dead. And I think now that Governor's gotten darker, he's getting to be a more interesting character. The threat that he brings to the series is getting more palpable. Before, I agree, he seemed kind of, you know, and see, I haven't read the comic book, so, you know, all of this is fresh to me. But he did seem kind of wimpy as a villain. And
So having zombie heads and fish tank and killing a whole bunch of soldiers just wasn't crazy enough for you.
No, because it's got to be, you know, crazy with the heads in the tank. That's not bad. You know, that's okay. Killing a soldier, that was expected. You know, from a bad guy tyrant. But you got to feel it throughout his character. You know, it's got to make sense why he's doing that, and you've got to be able to see it leaking out all around him. and it just, you know, he just seems so put together and so calm and quiet and not in a scary enough way. So now, you know, he's got the eye patch, he's the girl's gone. Now, you know, now he's going to start to release the crazy, and I think it's going to be a lot more interesting. And of course, you know, the team's making a run for the prison now, so that is a tangible kind of peril.
Yeah, I think it probably worked out probably from a television point of view the way they did it on screen, because I guess it served the story much better to have him roll out slower like that. Because just to kind of put it a little bit in context, just like for instance, like think about some of the situations that happened, like with the governor and Maggie and that business.
That was terrible.
We'll see. I'm not saying it went out down exactly like that, but that type of scenario was like the first thing that happened with the governor when he was introduced in the comic, you see. So like from the very beginning, it started with something like that. And, you know, so that's why it was so different if you had that kind of comic baggage with the show. But it seems like it was, I guess, worth the wait, I guess, because we're sort of back on track, you know, I guess, with the character.
Mm-hmm.
So it all works out. But
and I agree with you, Eric, in terms of the pacing, because they could have spent an awful lot of time in Woodbury, and that would not have moved the series along. You know, it'd been like from the farm to Mayberry.
That's
now,
what you thought was going to happen.
I was afraid. And they, you know, got on with it really quick. And of course, the thing that I really enjoy about Walking Dead, having not read the comic book, you have no idea who's going to live when you're watching Walking Dead. You really, you know, you think that there are certain untouchable characters, and you're used to the way that television normally, you know, carries people from season to season, whether, you know, they're going to make it or not. Come on, you know, I was sure Herschel was going to be gone by now. I mean, really, I mean, so you just when you think, you know, oh, that dude ain't going to make it. Or, you know, that person's going to be there till the series end. Pow! You know, mama's gone. You know, people, Herschel's limping around. You know, people are still, you don't know. You can't get comfortable with the cast on the show. And that's exciting to watch. So, hey.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you know, backtracking to season two for a second, that was some of the most shocking moments in season two.
Oh, man.
If you had the comic baggage. Mm-hmm. Because there was two things you weren't necessarily expecting at all. If you remember back to season two, one was Sophia. You remember the Carol's daughter?
Scene, sure.
Yeah. See, if you read the comic, you were not expecting that because Sophia goes much further on in the story than that, and so that really, you know, that's one of the little ways they tricked us as fans of the comic, and the other huge one was Dale. Because Dale also goes much further into the story, and there was a lot of other things he got involved with in the comic that just obviously aren't ever going to happen because we never expected him to die on the farm. Like, because that's not the way it went down. And so it was just like, holy crap. Now what? Like, how's this going to go? He was like an important character for like two more seasons, and he's just dead. So you never know with this thing. You never know what's going to happen, for sure.
That's how I like it. Yes.
Did y'all feel, I guess, relief at the finding of Carol? Or did y'all kind of suspect she was going to come out of the closet, as it were? Or,
I knew she wasn't dead. I knew for a variety of reasons. The main reason I knew she wasn't dead is because I don't find her character particularly interesting. So I was like, yeah, she's still sticking around. You know, I just knew. I mean, it was just the ethical balance of it. But there were enough hints. Like I said, Walking Dead, when people are dead, they are dead. And by that I mean, you know, the zombie is munching on his innards. Gee, I wonder if Dale's going to make it. No, you know, it was T-Dog, you know, three zombies crunching on his back. He's dead. You know, they don't play in Walking Dead. So if you see, you know, a wisp of a headdress falling down and a shadow of somebody, no, they ain't dead. In Walking Dead, you know when people are dead. So.
Or they explode at the CDC.
Exactly. That's, yeah. You ain't no coming back from that.
The only... well, I'm not going to talk about a spoiler, so whatever.
Okay.
Well, it was a kind of something that I heard about Rick that I didn't. I'm not sure about what I heard or not, so I don't even want to talk about it. So anyway, Andrea, she has become the annoying Carol of the season, and Carol is kind of hero like.
Andrea's been annoying for a long time. For me.
Well,
going back to season one.
Really? She didn't really get, like, she's really getting on people's nerves, and they don't like some of the choices she's making.
It's easy. I mean, season one, it was her constantly wanting to kill herself. No offense to anyone who's listening who wants to kill himself. But season two, it was when she shot Daryl in the head, among many other things. She's just constantly there to be a thorn in my side, I think, in the show.
Do you think she's going... Because I think we're seeing a thing where she's going to have to pick a side. And is she going to pick the side of the governor after she's seen all of the heads in the tank? Because it's been revealed to her. You know, she knows that he's been to Crazy Town.
Well, I was going to say I don't know. But then, I mean, if you watch that little... If you watch that little preview of things to come in season part two, you kind of, there's hints. So that kind of answer your question.
Okay. Well, I'll have to seek that out. What is your take on Andrea, Carl?
I kind of liked her, you know, getting rougher at the end of the second season. So, you know, between she getting stronger with the weapons and, you know, her getting a little more gruntled, you know, what's his name? We lost him. With Shane, you know, that whole Shane thing, she thing dynamic developing. I thought that was interesting that she was sort of like, you know, Shane's intern for a while there. Yeah, and it was fun to see her develop that way. when she got separated from the group and was out there making her own way and eventually, you know, meeting up with Michonne, I found all of that interesting. So I like that. Now that she is, you know, laid up with the governor, you know, obviously anybody watching the show can't go, yay, this is a great choice for her. You know, no, we're not liking that. But I think she's still got plenty of time and plenty of potential to do interesting things in the series. So while, of course, no, I'm not thrilled with her choices, I have a feeling that she will probably, you know, wake up and come back to be the fun character that we like.
She was fun.
Yeah, the other problem with Andrea in season three is the fact that you know, put her up against Michonne as a character. I mean, them being on two different sides of a coin. And with Michonne obviously being, like, super badass and, like, super cool and super likable from a viewer point of view. And with Andrea being essentially, like, the not Michonne because of situations, that's another thing that just doesn't bode well as far as her, like, likability meter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to ignore that when, you know, it's, come on, Michonne is, like, super smart and you're not.
What do y'all think about Rick seeing Shane in the battlefield at Woodbury? Like, why is he seeing Shane? Do y'all remember that?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What did you think? Because I was like, what? Holy, okay, yay! And then, so we've heard Shane on the phone. We've seen Shane. That's kind of exciting. I don't know. I liked it.
Well, I mean, to me, I think it's showing Rick's growing instability. You know, he's been through a lot. He's had a really hard time. You know, the wife got munched on, you know, you know, he had to shoot his buddy. So I think, you know, to me, it just felt like a description of his continuing deterioration. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we're starting to question Rick's perception and sanity. So, you know, that was kind of what I took from it. But that was it.
Yeah, I agree with everything Carl said, but at the same time, it was super fun. I thought it was a cool, worthy cameo, if you will. I thought it was awesome.
I miss Shane. I was sorry.
I don't miss him, but
I mean, I didn't miss what he was doing. I wish he would have grown as a character and stopped the whole, you know, I'm a badass, let me butt up against Rick thing, and maybe they could have worked together. I would have liked to have seen that, because I really thought he brought something. I like the kind of dynamic between the love triangle a little bit, but I don't know. I didn't want him to die, per se.
Yeah, I wasn't ready to see him go either. You know, and that's kind of the way it is with the series. The folks that you're really excited about seem to disappear too soon. And then the folks that you're maybe not so thrilled about hang on. They just hang around.
Isn't that life, though?
season after season. Still here. Still here.
Yeah. Well, see, Shane was the opposite case from the comic, where he was actually dispatched much earlier. So he had a much longer life on the series. Hmm. So, you know, it was one of those just opposite case of Dale.
Mm-hmm. So what do we think is going to happen between Merle and Daryl?
Ooh, that's rough.
Well, okay, Eric, you be quiet.
Well, I was going to say, I know nothing about them because neither exists in the comic, but...
Oh.
Yeah. I don't have any inside information or anything.
I just don't think, well, like, how is that going to work? I think it was kind of stupid for the governor to be, like, his logic to come up with to put Merle in the pit with his brother just was flawed. Like, oh, this is all happening because of Merle, and he loved his brother, so let's put him in the pit and let him fight to the death. That makes no sense.
Oh, it made sense to me, because, you know, he saw that Merle was starting to wake up, and the governor is, you know, I'm not going to say he's afraid of Merle, but he recognizes that Merle is really, really dangerous. So, you know, he's got to sell himself as the good guy to the town. He can't just up and kill Merle. And so he just found a very comfortable scenario to spin up. And at the same time, his hands are free. You know, his hands are clean. You know, I'm not killing Merle. You all see he's a traitor to the cause, and put him in the pit there to let him take care of each other. So, you know, there's a dastardly logic to that, that works for a villain. I don't find it strange. But what's going to happen after this in terms of Daryl and Merle? It seems like probably Merle's going to make his way back to the prison with Daryl and crew. But I just can't. He ain't a team player. You know, maybe
yeah,
he's going to be
the Shane.
Shane,
yeah.
Exactly. He'll be the new Shane.
Yeah. That's going to be, I don't know what that's going to be like. So, show of hands, who's tired of Carl Grimes and the hat?
No, I'm cool with that.
I'm sick of the hat. I want him to take it off. I'm sick of seeing him wear it.
I don't care about the hat.
Nope, I'm cool with the hat. I like it.
I'm bored.
No biggie.
Well, it's just...
Why are you hating on the hat?
I'm just sick of the hat. It's just like, take the freaking hat off like just once.
I think
wear the hat out the whole time.
I think Carl's getting more interesting this season, by the way.
Yes, I completely agree.
Because, I mean, it felt like Shane was saying in the last season, he said, "What are you trying to get yourself killed?" It was like, you know, he'd fall into the well, he'd walk into the zombie. Carl was just getting in the way all last season. Carl is rough now. You know, he's got a DL on the side, you know, start sparking up there. You know, he got a little girly that he's interested in.
Oh, dear.
He had to drop his own mom, you know. I'm like, Carl, rough. He is rough this season, so... Yeah, I'm getting the offense.
I love the part where Daryl was like, "Yeah, and my mom," and then I walked back home and she was burning to a crisp in the fire that she set with her cigarette. And Carl was like, "Well, I had to kill my mom." And
then nice. Yes, when you got Carl putting Daryl in his place, that I was like, "Oh yeah, this is getting good now."
Yeah.
I'm bringing it.
Super adorable.
That was a good one.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Any other things that's burning you about The Walking Dead other than it was a kick-ass season? Thoughts?
And see, this is what I'm talking about. The characters aren't too good-looking. The storylines are great and unpredictable. You know, the casting is solid. This, you know, these basic things that come together to make such a great show like Walking Dead, you look around and it's just inherently missing from everything else that you're watching. It's like,
yes, that's exactly the thought.
It's so seamless. And you know, when you see it done like this, you wonder, why isn't anyone else doing this on TV?
Yes.
Why is it this hard to make something so quality and so solid? But oh, it's great. I can't wait. It was killing me to see it end. I mean, for the season.
Oh, okay. I was like,
completely
what did
concur
you say
with what Carl just said. Because honestly, Walking Dead being so good and becoming so good now, it's the reason why I've pretty much I've shelved Falling Skies now, and it's a big part of the reason why I already had it with Revolution. Like, I think I stopped like about episode 5 or 6, and
I've watched them all. You aren't missing anything.
No, I wanted to quit after the pilot. I stuck it out for 5 or 6 episodes, and no more.
I'm two episodes behind on Revolution.
A lot of it has to do with The Walking Dead just being really, really amazing for all those reasons Carl just said. And one of the biggest things, come on, let's continue to shoot in places not Canada or even not Southern California. You know, Walking Dead's all shot in Georgia, in the Atlanta area, and it's awesome. And you can tell, and it shows, and you know it. One thing I thought was interesting... like for the exteriors of the prison, I was wondering about that set location or whatever. I did some reading and that actually the prison exterior, it's actually the studios where they filmed the show. They just they redressed the exterior of the actual studios and added the fence and the guard towers, and so that's the studio dubbing as the prison. And
that's
that's really cool. Like
that's why the grass is getting mowed.
But I just think it's brilliant. I love that. I love, you know, shows that just don't look like they're either on a soundstage or in Canada through the Stargate. Like
it's I'm telling you. With the casting, look at these people. They look like they've been through it. You know, seriously, they don't look all clean and, you know, young, youthful. And I mean, they've got all age ranges of people, but they really seem to fit in terms of how they look based on the situations they've been through and what their characters are saying.
And that's part of that's one of the major reasons I completely disown Revolution, because I could not buy everyone looking like they stepped out of an Old Navy catalog, like in the aftermath. Like, it just didn't make any sense to me. And then Falling Skies, for instance, okay, they do it a bit better, but Falling Skies, they just look like people who stepped out of an Old Navy catalog and then cleaned chimneys.
Yeah.
But that's the only difference between Revolution. Like, Walking Dead brings it all the way around full circle and adds, like, the weathering, and there's, like, a little bit of logic of why so-and-so has these particular items or this belt or whatever, you know, whatever the case.
And I don't understand why people don't see it, because it was Terra Nova was the same way. I mean, it's like, you're supposed to be telling a story and creating a believable space for stuff to be happening in. Well, why would you not, you know, start with the characters? You know, why do you think it's okay just to, well, you know, we'll make everyone look like they escaped from One Tree Hill, but, you know, we'll say it's post-apocalyptic, and sure, she's got on a leather jacket that's all tailored, but she's been roughing it in the woods. Well, you know, why does no one pay attention to that? Is that okay? People are all right with that? I mean, you look at the crew, Walking Dead, they've been wearing the same stuff. You know, their stuff's clothes getting raggedy. These people, you know, they can at least swing by a Walmart or something, and they still make it believable. So I don't know.
Yeah, the bar's been raised so high with so many shows in the last 5 years that's just something that's just, like, it's really unacceptable for me now, especially with genre shows. No, I'm serious. It just takes me out of it with those other shows.
Yeah, and it just seems like those other shows, the people working on it, they just don't care. They're trying to, they know, they feel like, we're going to get canceled in a season anyway, so we're just not going to bother. And so, it's, you know, they become victims of their own lack of care.
No offense to old Trek TV shows, or I mean, from the 90s and the aughts, but I mean, the same situation there with their Starfleet uniforms, and then they go through hell on some alien planet, and they just get some soot on their brow. Like, it never made any sense.
But yeah, they go back to the ship and they clean up. They have better things than Starfleet, don't you?
No, I understand when you get cleaned up again. But when they're in the thick of it, like, Harry Kim, like, had, like, two hair follicles that, like, went the wrong way. But everything else was perfect.
Like, well, you know, he's a Starfleet officer, and they know how to do that.
I'm more willing to give him a break on Star Trek than I am on all these.
Well, no. What I'm saying, though, that was the old standard. It was fine then, but if you came out with a new Trek show circa 2012, that ain't gonna fly now.
Oh no.
Well, I would hope not. Different. Yeah, I would hope not.
Even do that in the movie. I mean, they did a good thing in the movie.
The shows like Revolution are still in that old model of set dressing, etc. And that's what I'm saying. Like, no, things are different now.
It's not what we want.
I mean, BSG was part of the early revolution on that of making things look more real again. I'm just saying.
No, Carl is about to start with the Galacticam. And
well, no, I don't disagree that it, you know, between the casting, the outfits, the costuming, that Galactica was way more real than any of the, you know, the other stuff that we're talking about. They did a great job making stuff look real. So no argument there.
Yeah, I'm saying they started the trend, and people need to get on board with that with these the newer shows.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, like how Stargate Atlantis got on that?
No. Yeah. Again, they were back with the Star Trek models. Definitely.
Just had to throw a dig in there. Yeah. Skyline sucks. Okay, anyway. So I think I'm just ready to see where it's gonna go. And I just can't wait. Do we know when it's coming back? February, March?
Yeah, it's somewhere around there.
Are we going to have to wait until October?
No, it's in the spring. They I don't remember the exact date, but you're in the ballpark. It's like February or so.
Okay. Well, I can't wait because I don't know what else could happen next.
It's going to be a bit nutty. Well, I don't know how many episodes there are remaining, but it's going to be a little bit nutty just because Game of Thrones is going to kick back on like in March, and I might just die if I have both on at the same time.
Like, that's just two shows. What are you talking about?
Two good shows.
Two good ones.
Tell you, man, that's rough. Like, both on Sundays, probably. It's going to be nuts.
DVR.
So, in death, T-Dog got a full name, and it's Theodore Douglas, just to let everybody know out there.
By the way, do either of you happen to watch The Talking Dead that they show on ABC after? Because I've watched almost all of them for season two, and they're pretty good, obviously. Well, I mean, and one of the best ones was the Talking Dead following T-Dog's exit from the series, because they had the actor on, Irone Singleton, mm-hmm. and man, there's a small studio audience there, and he was just really, that show's taped live, and he was really emotional about leaving the show, and he was like almost tearing up because he all his love for his time on the show, etc. Like, it was weird. I mean, it was weird for me. I just like, wow.
It's not weird because he's not going to get another job for like 8 years. That's why he's tearing up.
I'm so mean.
I'm sorry. I'm not saying that he's a bad actor. It's just there are very rare opportunities, for casting where, he gets an opportunity. So he's like, man, this was a top show. I was having fun. Got to chop up zombies. Now what I'm going to do? Now he's just going to be like,
Maybe in season four they can have a little cameo of him running with a beard a la Shane.
Oh,
a weird flashback.
So sad.
Oh, there's a side note as well. Like, I don't know if anyone's seen the remake of The Fog, like 5-6 years ago?
I heard of
The
it.
Mist, you're talking about?
Oh, The Mist. Sorry, The Mist. The Mist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you saw? Oh, because I haven't seen it, but everyone always tells me, hey, go check that out if you want to see a bunch of the actors that we know and love from The Walking Dead.
What?
From before.
Wow.
They were in Walking Dead.
I actually liked The Mist. I was like, wow, this is actually what was that Stephen King? Is that Stephen King?
Yeah, it was a Stephen King
novel. It was probably one of the only like Stephen King remakes movies that I really, really enjoyed. I was like, wow, this is pretty good.
Yeah. So if you'd like to see a lot of our actors in a different situation, or a different setting, I guess you can go check that out.
You can watch Law & Order SVU because they're all on there.
Oh,
they all been on episodes. Yep.
Oh.
All of them.
Well, cool.
Maybe not Rick though, but all of the other ones were.
All right.
Yeah. So that is it for Walking Dead. It's been a great season. I loved it.
So good.
It's
so good.
Good times. Yeah.
And now we're going to get into The Hobbit.
Hobbits is.
Yeah.
A little indie pick out of New Zealand.
Not many have heard of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, I guess we'll just start kind of basic on that. Get some, I guess, first responses brief. I'll go first. I didn't hate it. I'll start with that. I didn't really have a problem with it. I thought, initial thoughts is, I thought it was a really beautiful film. I didn't see it in anything special, just kind of regular 2D. No numbered P something or another. I don't think so. But even still, I thought just the way everything lit up and responded to my eye, it was just beautiful, looking at the textiles of the clothing that they were wearing, looking at their beards and just the characteristics of their faces and the landscape. It just really, really looked good, and it looks, typical of Middle Earth, of what we've seen. I thought that the beginning was kind of slow, but it was in this case that I didn't mind, because it felt like a lazy meandering through the story and getting to know everyone, and I kind of actually enjoyed that, because sometimes I like, let's get in there, let's get the action, and let's do what we need to do, but it was just kind of easy going at the beginning, and I surprisingly appreciated that. Other than that, it felt like all of the other Lord of the Rings movies, except we didn't feature hobbits, we featured dwarves, and it was good. I enjoyed going back to Middle Earth. Unlike I said, like I did a rant about how I was going to hate it or something like that a few episodes ago. So, of course, I told you I was going to come back and live it So here we are with that. and I read some negative reviews, and you know, people complained about this one, but I know what they're saying, and I can kind of see that, but there's a lot of work, and I think if you just only saw it once and have complaints, that you probably should see it again, and you might like it a little bit more, because there was a lot of information there. Carl?
Wow. I did not hate it as well.
Wow.
I saw it in 3D, IMAX, HQ, what the, HV, what the, Eric, what's it called? High definition.
HFR?
There you go, high frame rate. Just basically every set of letters after the title that was available. I saw THX, IMAX, HDR. So I was really wanted to get the full new film experience that The Hobbit is about. You know, I hang out with a bunch of folks that, you know, are interested in film production and do things. So, you know, I went to try to experience the new filmmaking edge that you know, they're bringing to The Hobbit. And, you know, when they talk about the HFR, it's like almost twice as many frames per second as a normal films. That right, Eric? I forget what
it is. It's exactly twice.
It's twice as many. And so, you know, all of this between the 3D, the high frame rate, I wanted to see what that added to the motion picture. I was not entirely thrilled with the result. Just to kind of talk about the technical stuff, it felt like the speed was a little off. Like what I was watching was moving a little faster than life. Like, you know, it had been slightly fast-forwarded or time-compressed or something. And that was weird. I mean, that was throughout the whole film I felt that. I went with all of this because I thought that between the high frame rate, the 3D, and of course the excellent cinematography you normally expect from these guys, that somehow I was going to feel more connected to the world or more immersed in the world that was presented. And while it was blisteringly clear, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, the resolution was just eye-splitting. I could see every detail of what was going on. It wasn't a seamless kind of immersive experience. It felt kind of distracting in a lot of ways to me, and I was surprised by that. I I found in a lot of places distracting. So that was overlaid on top of everything that I experienced in the film. So letting go of the technical stuff, story wise, I thought it was okay. Like you said, Kat, it started really slow. And I appreciated what it was that they were trying to do in terms of, in just like Star Wars, where the pacing at the beginning is really slow because they're trying to make everything real to you. You know, just because you're in the Shire, or just because you're, you know, on this magical planet or Tatooine or whatever, you still got to ground the audience with what it is that you're seeing so that you'll have an emotional connection with it, so you can feel, oh, you know, the Shire is a place I'd like to be. And,
yeah.
Oh, I you know, I'm experiencing the family thing. But the thing is I had already felt that before.
You don't want to feel it again, Carl.
Well, I'm just saying, in the original, you know, in Lord of the Rings, in the first one, I had a real love for the Shire, a real appreciation for the life that was there, for the characters that were there, and I got the sense of, you know, this is the beginning of an epic. You know, it's a fairy tale beginning where, you know, you start with, you know, in the house, with the family, with a place that you can relate to. And then, oh, darn it, you know, my life isn't doing what it's supposed to, and the adventure begins. It's a typical way to unveil and to begin a hero's journey. So for multiple levels, I was ready, I've seen that, I'm good with that, and, you know, to be in the rich world that, you know, they created in The Hobbit, okay, you know, a little of that I'm ready for. But it felt a little long for me before things really got started. And, you know, the whole, you know, welcome to the Baggins home, you know, unwanted guest thing. it was cute, you know, but it went a little long. It went a little long. And, you know, that whole scene where he's finally running out with the contract and he's ready to, you know, I'm beginning an adventure. That should have happened a little bit sooner in the film for me. The other thing is, I don't know what it is, but I was having a hard time really bonding with the dwarves. You know, I just it just
were
I just
they too ugly?
No, well, it's not that. It's just that, you know, on one hand, we are supposed to appreciate and respect not just the history of who they were, and, you know, the world, the land that they created, and we're supposed to, you know, feel this connectedness with their loss, as well as the believability that they could be heroes. You know, that's, we're supposed, something that we are experiencing in the story and how things are told to us, we're supposed to be feeling that. That's part of why things are slow in the beginning, is because we're supposed to be relating to them, supposed to be connecting to them, as well as really appreciating the idea that they are, you know, they can be heroes. The other thing is, we are constantly reminded of, you know, the smallness of what hobbits are. And I don't mean in terms of stature. I mean in terms of their invisibility. They're underappreciated. They're, you know, they're not expected to deliver much. Okay, everybody, Gandalf's telling us, the even Bilbo's saying it. Everybody is saying it, right? But when you put them right up against the dwarves side by side, you know, they and technically, you know, he's big for a hobbit. It's really hard to appreciate his supposed invisibility and smallness when he's about the same size as, you know, the other guys. And you know, they didn't really do a good job of separating them in terms of character and relating that. So all of this, it's because I know the story, and it's because everything else, we go, okay, yes, now, yes, the dwarves are separate folks, and yes, okay, I know that they're supposed to be downtrodden and they're gonna be the hero and all of that, but there just wasn't enough separation between them to make me feel that, you know, the hero's journey was going one way or going another thing. And of course, you know, the head dwarf is this, you know, he's badass, right? He's supposed to be, you know, this king ruler kind of thing, and I couldn't really feel it. You know, even through this whole episode, they're telling, yeah, he chopped off the guy's hand, and he's bad, he's a gangster. I couldn't feel it. I just couldn't feel it throughout the whole movie. And I was trying to reach that. And the story of you know, the motion of Bilbo was a little bit more interesting than his, but I just couldn't get it. So that really, if you're missing those two key elements, then the story is not connecting with you the way that it should. And so it was pretty, and it was, you know, the pacing was decent after, you know, they got out of the Shire and everything, but I just couldn't quite connect the way that I have in all of the other Lord of the Rings movies. Everywhere else, it doesn't matter how tall they were, there was just sort of a sense of relevance and significance to each of the characters that came out, and for whatever reason, I didn't feel it. So that was my concern and my issue with The Hobbit. It was pretty. It was interesting. It was storybook in terms of what it should have been doing, but it didn't quite get there with me. So
wow,
that's it. I'm sorry,
wow. Eric.
Oh boy. Unfortunately, I'm me, so my answer has to be a little bit nuanced.
We expect no less, Eric.
Bring it!
Oh, dear. Well, first off, I mean, a lot of what Carl said is what I initially... That was my initial reaction to the film as well, and it's also mirrors the reaction of a lot of my friends who also saw this movie about the technical aspects and about the movie itself. And I have to say, because again, I felt kind of the same way when I watched it the first time. I watched it in the same format as Carl described, with all the letters after it and everything. And I was like, okay. I mean, I liked it, but like, I thought it felt like a 3, I guess, or something, the first time. But But I had to, but after I saw it, I reread like the first chapter of the book, which I hadn't read in years. And then because of the technical aspect, I really had to see it again. I finally decided. And so I watched it again today. This time I just saw it the way Kat did, in just regular 24 frames per second 2D. And what I thought was interesting right off the bat, seeing it the second time, is that as Carl described the 48 frames per second and the issues with it, what was weird is that now that I was watching it in 24 frames per second, it looked just like a normal movie. It looked like, you know, the original Lord of the Rings, whatever, or any other movie you've seen. And all of a sudden, I felt like I was super cheated. Because even though I didn't necessarily love the 48 frames per second, it was still, the experience of it was still like part of the movie ticket price. And now that that was taken away, I mean, it's almost like novelty, I guess, but now that it was taken away and I'm like, ugh, now it's just a regular movie.
Did you see it in 3D? Did you see 3D regular resolution? I mean, regular frame rate?
I saw the same as you for the 3D IMAX 48.
Mm-hmm. And when you went back to watch it,
just 2D 24. Okay. It was like any standard movie you've ever seen. The second time I watched it, and
so
now
like you're saying you felt cheated on the second viewing or the first viewing?
The second viewing, because I felt bad for everybody else there with me, because I'm like, none of you guys. Again, even though 48 frames per second has its issues, one of the selling points for me is that it's something you've never seen before, and that, even if they haven't worked the kinks out yet, to me that is very significant to see something you've never seen before on its own, whether it works completely or not. And then watching it in regular frame rate, all of a sudden now I was acutely aware of all the blurring and shut, like every time they did like a sweeping shot. And all of a sudden now I'm like, oh my god, now I can't watch regular movies, because now regular movies look all choppy and disjointed. I feel like there needs to be something in between now. Like, I want the good parts, the good elements of 48 frames, but then I also want a little bit of the 24, but there needs to be like a middle ground. Somebody needs to figure that out, because now I don't feel satisfied with one or the other, because I feel like I have to sacrifice something regardless of which format I choose. Because while I agree it was disjointing with the 48, especially in the beginning, and it, like, whoa, it really kind of took me out of it for the first 30, 45 minutes. But at a certain point, it started working for me in the new format. And one of the things that really looked eye-popping was the CGI characters. All of them. For some reason, regular humans look a little bit weird and like ethereal in 48 frames per second, but the CGI characters, holy crap, like they look, oh my god, where'd they hire that skinny guy, like with the big eyes? Because, man, Gollum never looked realer, and all the goblins and the goblin king and all, oh my goodness, and the big action scenes, the ones where there's thousands of people running around, those look amazing in 48 frames per second. You never seen anything like it. It's just ridiculous. So I don't know what the solution is, but it's a weird thing going both ways. But the movie itself, again, kind of same as what Carl said. I was kind of like, hey, I love Middle Earth. I love the original trilogy of films. Give me more. But there's a lot of redundancy, I guess you could say.
Yes, definitely.
But I had to think about it for a long time, and watching the second time, I got to focus on other things, since I wasn't so preoccupied with the 48 frames per second, and because I already knew it was already going to be in the film, I was just able to take it in more and enjoy it. And somebody else wrote a piece online, I think on Forbes.com, I'm kind of going to steal their point, but this guy, he was a big defender of this new film compared to the previous trilogy. And like, he likened it to, and I kind of noticed it once I started thinking about it after I read his article, that the overall tone of Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, is kind of like, it's a bit like the Christopher Nolan Batman films. It's much darker. Everyone's much more sullen the whole way through, except perhaps maybe at the very beginning of Fellowship of the Ring. But other than that, it's bad times in Middle-earth, in Lord of the Rings. In The Hobbit, it's more like, as a contrast to the Nolan Batman movies, it's more of the Avengers world of the film, where things are just a bit happier, despite our trials and tribulations. And there's a lot more little humor injected in The Hobbit as compared to the original trilogy. And I was worried about that going in because I had read some, you know, various reviews before I saw it, and people likened The Hobbit's tone to like the Star Wars prequels, especially The Phantom Menace.
Oh dear.
And that got me really worried about The Hobbit. I was really concerned. Radagast the Brown, a lot of people likened his character to Jar Jar Binks.
Who is that? Okay. Yeah.
The Brown. Yeah, and I was really worried having heard those things going in. But no, it worked out for me, and actually the second time through, like, appreciated almost all the humor, and everybody at both viewings I saw, everyone laughed at like every single joke and had a good time at all the silly little jokes and things that happened. And I kind of like that refreshing tone in The Hobbit. But I don't think it's fair to compare The Hobbit to like the trilogy as a whole, but I think it's fair to compare The Hobbit just to Fellowship of the Ring by itself. And I actually think now I like The Hobbit. I think it's better. I think it's a better film than The Fellowship of the Ring. To be honest, I really think it is, from top to bottom. And one of the best things for me is that, or best differences, even though I had already read all the Lord of the Rings when I watched the films when they were new, it pained me to death at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, seeing it in the theater on the first time, because I knew what was going to happen, and I knew how the first act was just, you know, the first act, and I knew there was so much more to come in act two and three, and it was painful when Fellowship ended, and I was like, oh my god, I have to wait a whole nother year, this is ridiculous. It felt so like one third being chopped off, and the least interesting third of the three. But with The Hobbit, it being in thirds as well now, The Hobbit Unexpected Journey, whatever it's called, by itself felt like more a complete movie on its own, if that makes sense, just for me.
Yeah.
I felt like there was a good beginning, middle, and end. I felt there was like a good story arc that was just more or less contained to this single film by itself. And so it felt like a more complete movie to me that could stand on its own, even though it is one of three, whereas Fellowship did not feel that way for me. That's another reason why I give it bonus points. Because it could end here, sort of. And I'm more comfortable now. I can wait another year, and I'm cool with it. Because I got my closure for the first third of The Hobbit. So, feel good about it.
Well, I'd be interested, because I haven't really read that many reviews, but I know, Eric, I spoke with you earlier, and you said that there was a lot of people kind of finding it mediocre or not as happy. Where's that coming from? What's going on? And Carl, are you one of those it was mediocre people, or are you like slightly higher, lower?
I'm slightly higher than mediocre, but not by much. I guess one of the issues, I can see that it is better times, and you know, like you were saying, between the two films, and so the pending doom that is coming, folks are not aware of, you know, and they hint at it in this film, you know, all around between, you know, Gandalf, well, all the mystical people kind of sense something is up. But there was something realer about the darker trilogy. This one felt kind of like, legend or something more Muppet-esque, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking Labyrinth at times.
Thank you, that's what I meant. I meant Labyrinth, there you go. It felt, you know, a little Henson-esque, and that was, you know, in terms of the, you know, the comedy and you know, the little jokes that were going on, and the stuff that was happening, you know, the the song that they broke out into, you know, earlier.
Now, that was a little too Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs for me. I was like, what is happening?
Yeah. Now I really like the somber song, and the battle song that they did was great. But that first one, they're the happy dozers, and you know they're throwing eggs around. I was like, oh no. You know, that was really hard.
It was almost like for dwarves, kind of racist.
it was hard. It was a little hard for me.
Yeah.
So you know, when you had the darkness of the other trilogy, it just made things feel more real and more concrete and more grounded, and you know you felt things are that things are seriously, you know, bad, and that's what everybody's got to overcome. And this one, things no pun intended, just seemed smaller, you know. It just you know, like the bad guy didn't seem as bad, you know. Oh, he's got a hook, okay, you know, he's mad, he set a fire to a tree, you know. Wow, he's got some dogs. I just didn't feel, you know, even when Saruman showed up, you know, I was like, Saruman is the man, so Saruman, when he showed up, you know, I was like, all right, you know, here's got some real dastardly messes going to break out now. And, I found the Emperor from episode one more dark and imposing. So I think that because you've got these people in the makeup and they've got this sort of dwarf and hobbit-esque lightness about them, you have to compensate for that by if not necessarily making the story darker, but you have to be aware that people are going to have a Muppet-esque view of them when they're doing that, and that you've got to do something to kind of bring it in and to make it more real. But, you know, given the peril and the scope and the scale of what this whole series is about, geez, the book is very dark. We've seen already how dark the other three were. I understand it's happier times, but you gotta bring us in with these characters in a way that's a little bit more grounded, I guess. And that the singing and the silliness just didn't quite sell it for me. And that was worrisome.
I guess one of the things that works for me, that in the lightness of The Hobbit, one of the things I like better about it for sure is in the original trilogy, our main protagonist at times is Frodo. And even going back to the old animated films of The Lord of the Rings, I never liked Frodo. I never liked him as the protagonist. He's always been the emo hobbit to me, and always, oh God, everything's always so, oh Sam, woe is me. And I've always hated that about Frodo's character in the book, in the films, in the new film, whatever. But with The Hobbit and Bilbo, as portrayed by Martin Freeman, my goodness, I love Bilbo. I love Bilbo the Hobbit, his character, because Martin Freeman, his two most popular roles, aside from this now and aside from Sherlock, he's known as playing Arthur Dent in the Hitchhikers film.
Yeah.
And he's, of course, known for playing Jim in the British version of The Office, who is a little bit like Jim in the American Office, but different, more British and crotchety. And Martin Freeman and the Arthur Dent, Frodo Dent.
Yes.
Frodo Dent, Bilbo Dent. I love it. I love it. I love all.
I actually feel what you're saying, Eric. He did feel very Arthur Dent.
Yes, I like that.
Totally agree.
I'll take that over emo Frodo any day of the week.
Emo Frodo.
I see that. I completely agree with you on that. I think that Bilbo is more interesting and likable than Frodo. I got that 100%. There just wasn't enough of him in it, you know, compared to the dwarves, because, you know, he's sharing the lead, you know, quote, the lead in this movie in terms of, well, you know, Gandalf too, but with the king dwarf, the king guy.
Yes.
And we're supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be the story of the dwarves and the king's, you know, trial and he coming back to power and proving himself and all of that. But I just couldn't feel it for him. I really like Frodo, the king. I was just like, you know, it just wasn't quite there.
So Thorne didn't work for you? Thorne Oakenshield, the king dwarf, if you will.
I liked him. I loved his.
I thought he was cool. Let me tell you who I thought he was channeling. If anybody remembers, what was it, The Sword and the Sorcerer from the 80s? You know that? The guy who had the sword with the three blades and the two would shoot? Wow. Okay. Well, if anybody remembers The Sword and Sorcerer, I saw that 1,000 times in the 80s.
Okay.
And it was like a low-rent Conan movie. And Thorne Oakenshield is very reminiscent of the lead character in Sword and the Sword. You never saw that, Carl?
I'm trying to dig deep. Hey, look, I saw a bunch of stuff back then. I don't. It may be lost in the files. I can't quite place that one.
Thorne was good times. Because it was always hard to visualize the individual dwarves, especially reading the book. It was nice because I even noticed in the original trilogy, since I rewatched Fellowship the last day or two, and in Fellowship when they only show a few dwarves besides Gimli, but whenever they do show a dwarf, they all just look like Gimli clones in the original trilogy, and it's so cool now to see like this eclectic bunch who don't all look the same.
Totally agree.
And it's, I mean, there's the cute one. There's the Bieber dwarf. So, you know, you get like a whole range. And it's pretty cool. I don't know. I really liked it. It's still hard to keep track of them all. But they still have their individual character storyline. The young ones trying to prove themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And the old wizened ones. And it's cool because, again, as they state in the film, they're not all the best of the best.
Right,
they're just the ones who showed up.
Yeah,
and that's really interesting.
And I do like the old one, so that's kind of cool. Yeah,
And I don't want to get crazy with the literary connections, but I can't help but think about some of that stuff. A lot of people know that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and all them were friends, and a lot of people know that they tied in a lot of things, like from the Bible and other things, into their stories with Narnia or Lord of the Rings, and I feel it in The Hobbit. I really do. The people that lost their land, that lost their homeland and had it taken away and want to take it back, they're the wandering people. They're the wandering chosen people, and I mean that's the biblical aspect, but it's also a retelling of Beowulf. Smaug is Grendel. And it's even, and like the movie The 13th Warrior is a retelling of Beowulf as well. The coincidence, it's 13 warriors who they like bring together, and then they bring on in that movie Bilbo was played by what's his name? Desperado, Spy Kids.
Antonio Banderas.
He plays the Bilbo character in 13th Warrior. When they all hook up to go take out the dragon, and it's just it's interesting. I mean, if you're a buff of any literary stuff, it's interesting to see Tolkien's take on that, you know, on that hero tale, a hero epic. And I don't know, I'm on board with it, and it gives me a lot to think about. There's a lot of Peter Jackson does this with all his films, with King Kong or the other trilogy. There's a lot of little hidden messages in the dialogue, a lot of little things. I don't know, just little lines of it. Like one that stands out to me is after Gandalf told the tale about how golf was supposedly invented, which is right out of the book, by the way. Well, almost all of it's right out of the book, the dialogue. But right after he tells that tale, and Bilbo's just like, "You liar, that didn't happen," and Gandalf says something to the effect of, "Well, you know, it was true, but every story is embellished a bit." And I almost felt like that was like Peter Jackson looking directly at me, or all the crazy fans who don't want any changes, like, from the book, and because people are just going to rail. What? Sauron did not go to Rivendell in the book. That did not happen. And Radagast was more in The Lord of the Rings, not in The Hobbit. Bah! But that was, like, just Peter Jackson's little way of saying, "Hey, this is my turn to tell it, and so just deal with it." And there's little hints like that from the director. I get that because I've been such a ridiculous fanboy of a lot of Peter Jackson stuff.
Oh, you mean like how in the first movies he kind of walked in screen on screen and belched like that. That was a joke, by the way.
Eric. Oh, because that's just supposed to be. Oh, because Peter Jackson did. He was
yeah,
on screen.
Yeah, and then yeah, and he belched.
I got confused. And, yeah,
because he's just kind of flicking. Well, you know, I liked it, you know, overall the film, but I had some like. I had a migraine, so I had to take some medication, so I was kind of loopy. And for the first part, all I could see was kind of like Star Trek. So I went on Twitter and I kind of joked that, ooh, the first 9 minutes of Star Trek was really great, because I love how, like, now they're focusing on the Klingons and the Ferengi and how, you know, kind of Hobbit or the Hobbit homes kind of look like the Ferengi homes. And then, like, the dwarves are kind of like Klingons because they have the whole warrior thing and they're loud and they sing songs and drink beer just like Klingons and stuff. And then, like, Gandalf could have been Sarek, you know? and then, like... so I just had this whole thing, like, who stole from whom? Of course, Gene Roddenberry had to do the stealing. But it just... It kind of was funny to me how closely resemble the Ferengi resemble hobbits. The hobbits, and then dwarves are really like Klingons. They kind of exact same people, and you can see like some of the Star Trek races reflected in that. And I'm
on the facial hair.
Yeah. But the thing that I kind of was like rolled my eyes at was we have Gandalf in the Hobbit home raising his voice and the whole place is going dark again. Seeing that, you know, we have them going on a journey across vast landscapes. Done that. We've have them in caves doing things with ugly orcs. Done that.
Were goblins.
But they were technically, I mean, they were basically the same. And also, have you guys had the misfortune of seeing Highlander: The Source? It was a sci-fi original movie of the Highlander franchise. It was terrible. The bad guy, was he goblin with the like hook goblin? He reminded me of the bad guy in Highlander: The Source, and I just could not be afraid of this guy because he was like a combination of the Highlander: The Source bad guy and Scar from like Lion King, and I was just not feeling him as a bad guy. He was too mustache twirly, and then the gross. Cellulite, I guess, was he a goblin too?
Goblin King.
He was like half Marshmallow Man from Ghostbusters, half Jabba the Hutt, and I just was distracted on that because he was so disgusting as well. So, I mean, I guess that was the point because, you know, he's a goblin. So, but, ew. And then the last thing that kind of took me out of The Hobbit at the end was like the eagles coming in to save the big ass eagles coming in to save everyone. All I could really say in my head was America, fuck yeah, because it was just seemed like, you know, like it was eagles and it's America.
Well,
and I know it has nothing to do with it, but that was going on.
No, but in a weird way. Oh, since you brought it up, I had to butt in for because to me, the eagles, I call them the Deus Ex eagles because to be honest, because. They are Deus Ex Machina in more ways than one, because in a weird way, they're just the only possible solution for the impossible literal cliffhanger.
Oh.
Okay? And the same thing happens. We see eagles 2 times in Lord of the Rings. Once when Gandalf is on the top of the tower in Isengard, and he does the same thing. He talks to the moth and then the eagle. He jumps off the tower and the eagle saves him. And then we see it again at the end of Return of the King, or near the end, in Mordor when Mount Doom or whatever it's called is blowing up and volcano style. And then the eagle saves like Frodo and Sam because there's no other possible way they could have been saved in that situation. Well, so they're Deus Ex Machina in a way. But then at the same time, I think the eagles, in the literary sense, literally represent like the hand of God, and it's almost like if it was Clash of the Titans, it's like Zeus kind of like, all right, I'll give you this one and I'll just like stick my hand in real quick and save you, because that's kind of what the eagles represent, because in the story because the real serious problem is what everybody said about Lord of the Rings, and it could be said again in this film. The eagles, like when they pick up Frodo and Sam at the mountain, Why didn't the Eagles just drop him off in the mountain in the first place, and we could have avoided like 6 hours of movie? And that's what a lot of people say. Like, you know, they could have avoided the spiders and the orcs and everything. And the same thing in this. Like, the eagle just picked him up off that cliff. Hey, eagle, Lonely Mountain, could you drop us off over there? Like, that'd be really helpful. But then we'd only have one film. So, like, I could see how it goes both ways. But, hey, I'm cool with the Eagles, man. The Eagles are awesome.
Yeah. Well, I just, like, does Ents exist at this point, and why weren't they hanging out helping?
Well, because they're in Fangorn. They're in Fangorn.
Oh, okay, because I don't know the map. Opposite. A little bit. Okay, so what's with these, like, proto Megatron Optimus Prime rock formations fighting? What was that? Because that was a little too Transformers for my taste.
They just are what they are. Or Neverending Story. I saw a lot of Neverending Story in this.
The rocks were stupid, and I rolled my eyes. I literally rolled my eyes when I saw the stupid rocks. Like, we're climbing a freaking mountain. We're doing all the crap that we can do. Oh, of course the mountain's going to move. And then, of course, they're in a rock war with each other.
Yes, because rocks that close together don't have much more to do than throw rocks at each other.
It's like humans standing around and like grabbing a random severed leg and hitting somebody with a severed leg. Like, you're going to hit somebody. You're a rock person hitting a person with a rock.
I know what you're saying, if we take it literally. But let's not forget The Hobbit was originally written for a children's audience. Even though it's not like any children's book you've ever read, but that was the intended audience. And just think, you know, you're a kid's reading the story and you're writing it, and you want to make up just a little. It's a little bit of a eye candy in a book sense, but just, oh, you know that thunder you hear? What? It's not, you know, it's not just lightning. It's actually giants throwing rocks at each other. You know, it's like a thing for the kids, and I'm totally cool with it.
Oh, so avalanches or mountains fighting.
Could be. Oh, come on. Where's your sense of wonder?
I dislike you right now.
I just want to back up for one moment, and I don't know if you guys have ever seen the YouTube series How It Should Have Ended, but if you go to How It Should Have Ended, Lord of the Rings, you'll see exactly what it was that we were talking about. And yes, that was my beef with this movie too. I'm like, really, Gandalf? Really, Eagles? Come on. You could have saved us like 6 movies by just dropping them off. Right? But anyway, yes, getting back to that.
It's about the journey and how you get there.
It
you
is.
Learn on mm-hmm. the way and all that other wank. I don't... Like, do the eagles not want to fly all the time? Like, where are they at other points? Are they, like, taking care of their eagle children?
Oh, but I mean,
what's going on? Are they building their eagle big, huge nests?
Yeah, if we wanted to make this a 12-part podcast, we could all break it down.
Eric, never mind, dude.
I'm just saying, just like the Ents. Like, there's the whole backstory of why they didn't do what they did until they did, like, you know.
Oh, right, I remember, because they don't like to interfere, and they take a long-ass time to make a decision.
They're so not humans, and they do things their own way, and the eagles are kind of the same way. They do things the eagle way, you know?
Oh, okay.
They don't always get involved with all those people.
Yeah, but anytime Gandalf sends a creepy butterfly, they come flying.
But again, like I said, they're supposed to be like the literary interpretation of like Zeus, or like, you know, a godlike figure kind of stepping in.
So he only responds to like butterfly and oh.
That's just a communication tool. The moths aren't in the book, by the way.
I think maybe I don't understand Hand of God then, so.
Like I said, like Clash of the Titans, you know, the gods are just up there.
Yeah, I get that. That doesn't make sense either. It's stupid.
Well. It's just mythology stuff. You know?
Mythology, stupid.
Erica, fuck yeah.
That's exactly what went through my head when I saw those eagles swooping in, and I thought about the Colbert Report and that eagle and the intro to his show and how it's all big and squawky and ridiculous. And I was like, seeing these eagles, and it was comedy for me. It's like, why is this happening? Because it feels way too American right now. But I mean, I know eagles aren't American, but I just I was looking.
I was a little disappointed at how easy the out was. I mean, especially seeing as, like Eric was saying, it's the same out we had in the last movie. So,
well, the thing is that I didn't look closely, and I thought in the last movie maybe it was owls, and then I thought maybe I confused that with Harry Potter and that the owls weren't that big in Harry Potter. So then I got confused. So it seemed new to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. Well, you know, I've been like on anti-Middle Earth for like the past 5 years, so
yeah, I don't know what's
and
up
then,
with that.
And then now I'm okay.
No, I've not never been anti-Middle Earth.
Well, I've just got tired of it, so I had to like completely purge myself of it for it to feel new again and not be upsetting and boring. And I ended up enjoying myself. You know, we can roll back the tape from like 5 podcasts ago. We knew I was going to say this, but it's my creative process, folks, deal.
Yes, you go with that, girl. Yeah. It's all right.
Mm. Or it's crazy time. Whatever, you know. Y'all know me by now. Yeah, so was this too similar to the other films? Was it formulaic? It felt a little like you don't want to bash it because it was good, but it felt like there was a formula there.
Yep, I agree.
Okay.
Well, there was that formula, you know, as I said, you know, these are all similar stories being told over and over again. It just a little
but
bit
it
different
felt
touches.
Like the Lord of the Rings formula. You have the cave, you have Gandalf in the Hobbit home yelling, doing, and it gets dark. You have somebody find the ring. Why would
Yes.
But you have somebody, you go fight in the cave, you fight the orc type.
Aside from the fact that it's written like that, obviously, I look at it at the way, and this is controversial to some as well, but I mean, like, when you watch all the documentaries on the prequel Star Wars films and you hear Lucas talk about like his vision for all that business, and he talks about how his like grand scheme with the prequels is sort of like as six put together, it's sort of like an opera, and so it's like certain like history kind of repeats itself, you know, similar yeah. situations that would happen with Anakin would happen to Luke, you know, and just like a lot of that kind of stuff going on.
Yep.
And you know, some people dig that, some people really don't dig that in the Star Wars prequels. But
like, why would you want to make something where instead of hobbits and orcs,
because it's
dwarves and goblins, and it's the same film only slightly different?
It's because it's like Back to the Future when like Marty's in 1985 in high school, and then principal's like grabbing him by the ear, and then he goes back to 1955 and his dad is like getting grabbed by the ear. It's that whole kind of thing. It's that whole generational thing.
Now understand, now I got that, and I appreciated that, but that was only like 8 minutes out of the, you know, the movie series. It wasn't half of the film.
I understand, but I mean, like, for instance, when Gandalf faces the Goblin King on the Little Bridge, this obviously occurring before the Lord of the Rings, it was like, hey, this is like what happened with the Balrog in the Misty Mountains, except this is like a silly, dumbed-down version because this Goblin King is no Balrog, and this little wooden bridge is no ginormous stone bridge. And it was kind of cool. To me, it was like, you know, if you retroactively think about it, it's kind of cool to see, like, this is the little mini version, and because Lord of the Rings happens, obviously, later in the chronology,
I would have rather seen something different. Then.
I would have rather seen something different, too.
Yeah, I really thought he was going to say, you shall not pass, and yep. I was going to get up and walk out, because yep. that would have been too much. However, it was changed up a little bit, but the formula, it's like, oh, so we're going to see this formula 2 more freaking times, and I'll go see it.
Oh, well, not so. Sure. Because
all of the other movies had the same layout, or the just things happen just a tiny bit different.
No, but that's because the first half of the Hobbit book is very much like the Fellowship of the Ring, the first third. I mean, that's what we've just been talking about. But what happens to come in the future is not like the Two Towers and is not like Return of the King. So I expect a lot more, you know, divergent paths.
So what if for the movie, and to like please some random stupid person, they say, well, let's put the formula and just have, you know,
well, no, to make it more simple, this is the same, it reminds me of the same argument we kind of covered when we were talking about John Carpenter and how people would see that movie and go, I saw this in Star Wars. And
you mean John Carter?
John Carter. So I keep calling it John Carter.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. I'm John Carter. And how everyone's like, well, this is just like recycling sci-fi stuff I've already seen. But then you have to remember that John Carter was the first one.
But now you know I'm
verse.
Listen, and you know I'm
the first one.
No, listen, you know I'm on your side with that. But the problem is within the same movie series, you don't want to be doing that much repetition. Like, I mean, with the John Carter thing, yes, they were the trailblazers, they were the first. But, you know, and you can say, oh, it's like Star Wars. But to within the same movie series to be recycling, and I'm not talking about broad, you know, allegorical themes. I'm talking about they're running across a narrow bridge. I'm talking about they're back in the Shire having an argument. It's like the very same kind of thing. And what bothered me more, not just the repetition, but it was bigger in the Lord of the Rings movies. The scale, this is what I was talking about. The scale of what we have already seen already was bigger in what we've seen already. So now we're repeating it, but it's smaller. It's like Enterprise versus Star Trek, you know, and all the ones that followed it. It's like, you know, I've watched the Enterprise D, you know, barrel across space already. Now here we are on, you know, the NX-1, and they're going, ooh, if only we had some sort of phasing laser of some kind. It's like, oh, geez, you know, I'm not going to wait an entire four seasons to see a phaser invented. You know, if only a transportation device was available. Oh, my God. You're killing me, people. So, you know, it's like that. You're right. It's the smaller version of Lord of the Rings, but we've seen all that stuff before. I'm not going to make it through three of these if we get the same kind of callback.
As I said, different stuff to come. You know,
I sure hope so.
The two to follow, because as I said,
and when you say different stuff, it better not be bigger helmets, because that is not qualify as enough. This guy has a hook. Oh,
I'm just saying, because if we treat Middle Earth like it's a real living world, like they sort of had to go the same path, because geographically speaking, you had to go to Rivendell first, and then you got the mountains, and so it's the same reason. The same reason that they're doing the repeating history is because they have to cover the same land. You know what I mean?
So we never get to see, except for the beginning montage, the dwarves in their, I guess, natural original habitat. So in both movies, we get to see the mountain that they're trying to reclaim as, you know, nothing.
What?
Well, what? I mean, because they were, it had gold, it was a thriving community,
yes.
The dragon came in, so we'll never get to, in current times, see the dwarves in their glory.
That is correct.
Yeah. It's like the same shit, so they're like, in both time periods, in the span of these two series, or this whole thing, they're displaced, and like, why can't we spend more time on their glory days? Because I wanted to see more of that.
Well, if the next the movie...
Well, again, it's kind of like... Well, it's like what the book does. It hints back to these amazing things that happened in the history of the characters in the story, and these, like, legendary tales. And so it's portrayed, like, in the original trilogy and in this, like, the way it is in the book. It's like, you know, it's backstory.
Well, in the next movie, if they are trying to break into an impenetrable fortress and require the calling together of multiple teams of their folks to break through a barrier, large barrier of some kind to enter the fortress, that would not qualify as different enough for me to be excited about the next film. You know, of course, we know there are basic story elements there. You know, there's certain themes that need to be repeated. But if I see Helm's Deep coming in Hobbit 2 again, I'm going to be a little disappointed.
You might as well prepare for it, because Helm's Deep...
My thing is, I kind of know what to expect in the second Hobbit film, and I'm looking forward to that greatly. But at this point, I don't really have a clue what's going to happen in the third Hobbit film. It's very unclear to me. I have no idea. Okay. So I look forward to finding out, because I honestly don't know. Because I don't know. Just from little things that, you know, Peter Jackson's kind of thrown out there. It's very cryptic about the third film, and I'm very curious because I don't know. And I hope to find out. Like, I'm looking forward to that.
I really want
to
see something different and not just the H3P12221 added to 3D glasses and IMAX, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. It's cool for me. I really warmed up
That's
to it.
That's fine,
on my second
but I want
to
see something.
No, I want to see something else too, but I was glad to have this because, as I already stated early in the podcast, I think, just for me personally, I think this is a better film on its own than Fellowship on its own.
Did they change the Hobbit feet?
No.
The design of them? Because these look different. These feet look different, like less hairy and more like foamy or something.
Well, like, what do you mean these feet? You mean just
the
Bilbo?
Feet in this, yeah. The
but I mean, because they may have been slightly smaller. Him.
They're smaller because they seem bigger with less hair.
Yep. They it did seem slightly smaller. The feet seem smaller.
Mm. Well, they seem more foamy or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the hands are weird. Like, everybody's hands in the film look...
All the dwarves have chubby hands.
Yeah, they like sausage fingers.
And yeah, it's kind totally, of... totally.
Okay. Because Gandalf had sausage fingers, too.
Yeah, he
but
did
I thought just because he was big. Or human.
Yeah, Gandalf, he's interesting. I don't know. He goes through a lot of different looks across all the various films.
Well, so I was wondering why he didn't use more magic, but I figured he was younger here, so he wouldn't.
Yeah, I was always disappointed with the level of magic use from Gandalf. Yeah. He ends up being more like the MacGyver of wizards than anyone else. He's like, well, I could cast a spell here, but let me see what I can do with this tree branch, rubber band, and some duct tape. Hang on, you guys. Hang on to the tree. I'll be right back.
Yeah.
I'll hand you a staff while you're falling off a tree. You're a freaking wizard, man.
He's kind of like the father figure who just wants to nudge you along, but not do it for you and kind of
forces
you. Yeah,
that's when they walk to the Thorin rock. Like, did nobody know that the rocks are alive and they throw shit at each other? Like, nobody knew that?
Yeah, well, one of the dwarves was like, he was like, they are real. Yeah, like,
the legends are true.
Yeah.
But I pointed at the map, the legend's right here, guys. Look out. It's right here.
I don't know. Well, it was enjoyable. However, you know, we have our little nitpicks and we want to see more, but I think overall they did a great job.
As I really loved The Hobbit, but just sticking to films of 2012, I mean, it barely cracks my top five just of 2012, just because there's been so much in 2012 that was awesome.
That's exactly my rating.
But, yeah, but even if it is, like, let's say my number six of 2012, that's still extremely respectable considering the competition. So I'm totally cool with that. Like, it may have been number six for me this year, but had this been last year or the year before, it very well could have been, like, number two, mm-hmm. You know?
Tough competition this year, that's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's cool. Okay. It was better than Breaking Dawn Part 2, I'll say that.
I did not see that.
I did not see that either.
I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, man.
Yeah. What's his name?
Who are we talking about?
My precious.
Christopher Pine. Oh, Andy Serkis. Gollum.
Gollum, thank you.
Smeagol,
he looked different. He looked more something.
This is the younger Gollum, so you know he was less crazy looking because he was.
No, he looked the same amount of crazy. he just something up with the animation. They've done something different.
Well. He looked more real to me for sure, but again, a lot of that had to do with the 48 FPS.
He looked more.
Well, what I like is that
because he didn't look more real. He looked the same, but he looked more like he had Botox or something.
He's younger.
Yeah, he kind of looked a little bit more like porcelain-y, little bit. But what I like too is that Smeagol, he got the Jackson memo too, like to play it up for laughs a bit more, and so even in his dark, dank cave, he threw in a little bit of humor. Which I thought was pretty cool too.
It's understandable that he would be more happy because he had the rashes at that time. So, you know, the precious hadn't been stolen yet. So he's happy-go-lucky eating fish and, you know, random orcs or whatever falling down in there. He's happy. But things are about to change for poor Gollum.
Yeah.
Gollum was awesome. And I said this back with Return of the King or Two Towers, where I was like, Andy Serkis should at least get nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And I will repeat that mantra now. I'm not saying he has to win, but I think it'd just be awesome for him to get a nod for an Oscar nomination for his.
He's great. He was great. Yeah. Yeah. It was great seeing him again.
So how much more? Because I know I watched the Hobbit cartoon. What else do we have to do? Because I know that what I remember is that he goes down, he gets the ring, and like, what the hell else are they going to do? And that's rhetorical. I don't want you to answer that, but
I'm ready to answer.
Yeah, so we're just gonna do a whole bunch of dwarf stuff,
There's a geographic space they need to cross.
Oh, to get to the mountain.
Yes, and that's what I'm expecting.
And so the eagles just
how it should have ended. They're on a break. Like, eagles are on a break.
Why didn't they just like, couldn't he could, okay, so why didn't he talk to the butterfly and then talk to the eagle in order to tell whatever to tell the eagles just to take them to the mountain that they needed to get to?
It's that mythology that you hate that you spoke about. You see,
because they're not using logic.
No, it's that, I know it sounds trite, but that whole it's about the journey, not the destination.
But they already did a journey.
I know, but that was only the first leg of the journey. And
so because humans have two legs, we're going to go on another leg, or is it going to be like spider legs and there's eight legs?
Again, they have that geographical expanse to cross. And now you're saying, why didn't the eagles just take them across that expanse? Well, and I would argue it's because we still need more character development. And what I mean is, not that I need to know Bilbo better. That's not what I mean. What I mean is,
they got to grow up as a species first.
Yes, thank you. The characters have to evolve themselves within the confines of the story. Just like in this first chapter, we saw the growth of Bilbo's character from the unsure hobbit that he was at the beginning to the hobbit that everyone loved and considered as a brother that they could depend on.
Now I'm starting to kind of see that was why I was a little tired of Middle-earth.
Oh, okay. Well, see, that's why the eagles... The mythological godlike creature, they know this somehow, and they know if they just picked them up from the Shire and dropped them off at the Lonely Mountain, they would have all been eviscerated in the first 2 seconds because they hadn't become a team yet.
Yep.
You know, Bilbo like didn't find his courage, the Tin Man didn't find his heart.
It's just like a video game. You can't jump straight to the end until you have accumulated all of the things that you
need.
And so it's just why didn't anybody just give him a walkthrough? Eagles would have done, give him a walkthrough.
Again, missing the whole purpose of the journey.
Yeah, you got to the end, really all you wanted to see was like what happened.
I'm not in that camp.
I mean, I know journeys are pretty great, but you know, don't travel the journey the same way.
They had to cover the same geographic space in Middle Earth. It'd be like, hey man, to get to Dallas, we got to go through Austin. Wait a second, this looks the same as the road I took to Austin last time.
Have to encounter the same people on the way.
Do you have to stop at McDonald's in the same order? Do you go to Chili's? Switch it up. Go to Applebee's.
Wait. My father went to this Waffle House, and therefore I must.
As I said, they went to the goblins this time as opposed to the orcs. Oh,
so you change, like, you want to go to Dallas, but you don't want to take the same people with you, so you change the people but keep the journey the same.
No, I'm just saying this part of the journey is the same because except in the first journey, we were heading to Dallas after Austin, but now we've hit Austin, now we're going to make a little U-turn at Houston.
Houston if you're going to Austin? Austin is middle way between Houston and Dallas. If you're at Austin, it would be, and your destination is Dallas, it would make more sense to go
to
Dallas.
The Misty Mountains are like the Austin, and you could go either left and hit Dallas, which is the Lonely Mountain, or go right and go to Isengard or Lothlorien.
Are we saying Houston is Mordor? I'm a little confused.
No, that's New Orleans. I don't.
Nice.
Not to Gilead is right there by Texarkana, and you just keep going straight through to New Orleans, NOLA. So, there you go. Yeah. Where Sauron is having his little...
I
just wanted to mention Mardi Gras and Mordor.
Let's simmer down. All right. Well, so, you know, we're grumpy.
That was some ridiculous geography just now. I love geography. That was awesome.
Yeah, zip it. We're grumpy, but somehow like the film at the same time. So, I mean, I wouldn't if someone were to hear this and say, oh, you just hated the whole thing and blah, 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 blah. No, you just want to see a little bit more. It was still good. I think they should still be proud of themselves. They put out a really good, product. Anything to add to anything?
It's kind of obvious, but the only thing I want to add to that is just that, again, it's a new trilogy. Everyone's talking about it like this is supposed to be part four of what we've already seen, but it's not part four because they have to pull their punches. They really do, because they can't start off.
You're saying they did this already? Pulled punches? Because I think
this film that we watched was them desperately trying to pull their punches and hold back.
It's
because
like
they got four movies.
It's like watching Enterprise after we've seen Next Generation.
Yes, what Carl said. It's true. But
that was not a good thing. Enterprise
is
not.
So.
I like Enterprise, but.
Yeah, but you like Skyline too, so we can't really trust you.
I'm just saying it like it is. And so you can't treat this as a part four or a Return of the King, like, you know, kitchen sink. All the money's on the screen, because then what are you gonna do for the next two? Like, you paint yourself into a movie.
Stretch this into three movies in the first place. We're gonna be bored.
That was one of the concerns in the beginning. But I'll say it one last time. If you're thinking about you think about World War I and the challenges and the folk, you know, the issues that people had to contend with in World War I, the technology, the weaponry. You know, the soldiers and everything. And then you're looking at World War II, two different eras. Now, it's a conflict, and sometimes the victors and the villains are about the same. Stuff is the same. But the whole feel of those are different. And true. That's kind of what I was hoping. You know, I understand that this is not a prequel, but, you know, it's a trilogy that occurred before the first one. You said they're pulling their punches, but they don't have to. You can have something equally epic, but just different. And that's what I was hoping to see. You know, it's going to be, I wanted it to be just as big as Lord of the Rings, but I wanted it to be different. And so far, I feel like you said, I feel like they're pulling punches instead of giving us something that's equal or bigger or different. And that's
like
that's
I said, we have new sights to see that we've never seen yet.
Waiting for that.
Mm-hmm.
Got two films of that.
Because the rock giants didn't cut it, and that's the only pretty much
only
different
thing.
That
was different. Yep.
Well, it's all new territory because we traveled over lands. We saw
nuanced new,
and now we're seeing new. We're going to see. We'll see new lands that have not yet been visited on screen in Middle Earth. So,
that's what I'm waiting for. That's what for.
Okay. Well, that is our Hobbit review. We hope you enjoyed that one. If you did not, you may tweet Eric at Bullet Who or Robo Minister at Robo Minister or whatever.
Right.
But not me. That's the whole point I'm trying to get at, because I don't want to hear it.
Cat loves your
entertain all comers.
As a matter of fact, if you are looking for, you know, where your boyfriend is, it's okay to contact her for that as well.
I stole your boyfriend.
Look out, Kat.
You can tweet us at Sci-Fi Party Line. We're on Facebook as well. You can also go to our website and comment directly there. It's scifipartyline.com. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you at the party next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
End of line.